Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, a time set aside in various parts of the world to remember the victims of the 20th century's greatest crime, Nazi Germany's murder of 6 million Jews. That number might have been higher had an untold number, certainly many tens of thousands of Jews, not found ways to escape. Some fled Germany and Nazi-occupied Europe, some survived the hideous death camps, some simply waited out the war by hiding. I'm Don Marsh. We have two guests on today's program with a remarkable story of survival who did just that, hid almost within the shadow of an infamous death camp. Polish-born Mike and Jerry Koenig were youngsters who managed to escape the Warsaw Ghetto, a story in and of itself. It is even more remarkable after that escape. Jerry lives in Chesterfield. He joins me in studio, as does his brother Mike. Mike makes his home in Israel and is currently visiting his brother. Gentlemen, so nice to have you with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Mike, welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you. I was just asking before we went on the air how old, it's best, I guess, to find out what year you were born. Then we can go from there. Jerry?
1930, January 1.
January 1930. Welcome to the 30s, right?
Thank you.
Mike, how about you?
October 18th, 1932.
Well, you were 8 years old and a little younger than that when Hitler started his adventures in Austria and Czechoslovakia. Jerry, let me start with you. Give me some sense of what you remember of your life before everything crashed.
Life was pretty good for us. There were some signs of anti-Semitism, which have existed in Poland for a long, long time. But in general, as far as our family was concerned, lived in a small town, a suburb of Warsaw, and life was pretty good. Dad was involved in a lot of things, and financially we were a middle-income family, and things were not too bad.
And Mike, probably a little too young to really understand what was going on as well as your parents might have.
This is certainly true, okay? But I do have memories of those years, even as a seven-year-old. Okay, first of all, as Jerry mentioned, there was quite a bit of anti-Semitism on the street. And even as a youngster, whenever I would go out on the street, parents would push me in a little wagon, you know, little baby, sure. This. I did sense the hostility. But you are right in the sense that I was not fully aware what's going on, okay? When the war broke out, just before the war broke out, I did hear the adults saying that some bad things are coming. I saw the windows being taped up just in case there was a... And I saw some panic, people wearing gas masks, improvised gas masks, walking on the street, okay? So I sense that something is coming up. But you are right, absolutely, a seven-year-old cannot fully comprehend what's going on.
What form did the hostility take?
The hostility expressed itself in many ways, okay? One was, for instance, if a Jewish child walked out on the street, there is a good chance that he was being harangued. Is this the right word?
Harangued, okay. Harassed, sure.
Harassed, okay. Mm-hmm. Not so much physically, although I was physically one time harassed, and that was after the Holocaust. But they would make fun of us, okay? They would sing songs and simply poke fun at us, deride us, and humiliate us, okay? And this was sensed even when I was a seven-year-old.
Right. Jerry, what are your recollections of that kind of harassment and hostility?
Pretty much the same. Somehow or another, it was known that we were from a Jewish family. And if you walked out, there were stones thrown at you and derogatory names were used. And however, the days when we went to school, to the gymnasium, as it's called in Europe, things weren't too bad.
Were your parents communicating with you at all with regard to be careful, as Mike said, you know, something bad is coming?
Well, we were fully aware. I don't know about Mike, but I can speak for myself. At my age, I was fully aware of what was coming because we listened to the news. It was common knowledge what transpired in Germany. And the signs of war were everywhere. The Polish government did a lot of, well, let's say, bragging. We don't have to worry about anything. There is a war. We're going to win it because we have powerful allies. We have England and France on our side. We have a pact. And if we are attacked, they'll come to our aid. Well, we know differently. History tells us that they didn't, and they had their own problems later on. But the kids were not excluded. There were a lot of talks among the adults, you know, what is going to happen. Having the knowledge of what transpired in Germany with the Kristallnacht and the book burning and so on, we expected that if the day should arrive when we were occupied, that most likely the same methods were going to be used here.
And, of course, that day did come, and the Germans came in very, very quickly. Not much resistance because the Polish army was not as modern and well-equipped.
4 weeks.
4 weeks, a month.
Took four weeks.
Mike?
I want to add something here. In 1938, Germany expelled its Jews under very cruel conditions. And apparently our family knew one of those families. And they came to us, and no doubt they told us what's going on in Germany. They felt it on their own skin. And that would have been the time for our parents to pack up the bags and leave Poland. Okay, and to this day, I don't know why they didn't do it, but there are ties, and there are things which you cannot leave behind, okay? But that was the time to just pack up and go.
Well, in order to move the story along, because it is so dramatic in so many different levels, once the Germans take over the country, as you pointed out, Jerry, they did it in a month, then became the crackdown on the Jewish population.
Well, it started out with methods that maybe were not life-threatening, but as an example, first of all, you were identified as a Jew, because if you were Jewish, you had to wear an armband. And on your right sleeve, which was white with a blue mug and David or Star of David on it, and that identified you. You had to wear one every time you were out in the public. The rules were that if you encountered a soldier, a German soldier, on the sidewalk, you were not allowed to remain on the sidewalk, but had to step down onto the pavement and bow down. And if you were lucky, he didn't hit you. And once he passed, you were allowed to get back on the sidewalk. Life-threatening? No.
Humiliating?
Humiliating, yes. You bet.
Yeah. Let's take it to the Warsaw Ghetto. How long did it take before people were put in those 100 square blocks, I guess it was?
Well, first, a ghetto came in our hometown, with the suburb of Warsaw. Mm-hmm. And that was throughout Poland. It was not just our town that was exposed to this. But in the meantime, every large city was getting a ghetto. And, of course, the closest, largest city to us was Warsaw. So after approximately, I would say, maybe a year, after about five families were crammed into this tiny little house, so crowding was already pretty bad.
Sure.
And, of course, food supplies were meager.
Disease
because
also.
Everything was rationed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Disease also an issue with in those crowded conditions.
Disease, did you say?
Yeah.
Not that early in the game. Not that early in the game. But the situation was totally different once we were told to pack up again and move, put on trucks, and carted off in an unknown direction. We didn't know where we were going. Mm-hmm. Well, the destination was Warsaw. Mm-hmm. And by the time we arrived there, they just simply told us to get out, and we were on our own. There, the ghetto was walled off. It was a brick wall, probably somewhere around 8 to 10 feet high, with broken glass and barbed wire on top. And there were a few gates, you know, through which you could enter or exit if you had the permit. And we were just at our own resources.
You had to find a place to live, and you had to find a way to survive. They just dropped you off and said.
The fortunate thing was money helps. Mm-hmm. And as I told you before, parents were fairly well off for Polish standards, and they brought with them some financial resources. And because of that, we were able to survive for a certain length of time in the Warsaw Ghetto by buying food on the black market.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of where you lived?
We did get some kind of an apartment that we shared with my grandparents. And grandparents were in a different location, but it was my uncle and aunt and their daughter.
Did you have other siblings? Was it just the two of you?
Just the two of us.
Did you have any sense, Mike, once you were in the ghetto, and obviously we understand what it was, but did you think anything like, well, we're here now, I guess we're going to be okay now because we're here and this is where what they've decided to do with us?
It was not quite possible to think in a very optimistic way. You have to realize that when I stepped out of the doors, I would walk on a street where there are dead bodies lying covered with newspapers. Because the method of the Germans at that time, this was before the establishment of the death camps, okay? Mm-hmm. And I guess they were trying to find a way before the Wannsee Conference of how to get rid of Jews in some other way. So they established the ghetto. And obviously the plan was to kill the Jews by both starvation and disease. And they were dying. They were dying. And I, as a young boy, some 8 years old, was walking on a street which was strewn with the dead bodies covered with newspapers. Excuse me. This stayed in my memory. And also the little children with their little cups begging for something, some sort of a donation, either in food or in money. They were practically little skeletons already. So some of these things, I could not have felt very optimistic at that time. Did I foresee that something like this will lead to worse things? No, at that time I did not.
Sure, a small child would not be expected to.
Right.
I have to take a break now. We're talking with Jerry and Mike Koenig. They're two Holocaust survivors. They were born and raised in Poland, as we've heard us discuss, and we're leaving the story for a break now at the point in their lives in which they were put into the Warsaw Ghetto. But they escaped from the ghetto, and we'll talk about that when we come back with Jerry and Mike Koenig. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Jerry and Mike Koenig in just a moment. They are Holocaust survivors. This is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and that's one of the reasons why we're talking with these two gentlemen. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Kansas City Mayor Sly James and St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay will hold a news conference later today in Jefferson City. They are opposed to a bill that would create penalties against federal agents who enforce gun laws that conflict with state laws. The Missouri Senate plans to debate and vote on the proposed state budget for the 2015 fiscal year. That would set the stage for negotiations with the House over a final version that is required by the state constitution to be passed by May 9th. The St. Louis Metropolitan Clergy Coalition said earlier today that it supports the transformation plan for the St. Louis Public School District. Announced last month, the plan would give greater flexibility to those schools with the greatest academic success, and the district could seek nonprofit operators to take over the schools in the lowest tier if improvements are not made. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Holocaust survivors Jerry and Mike Koenig. Jerry, let me come back to you. How did you get out of the ghetto?
Well, it's somewhat of an involved story, but we actually smuggled out. First of all, let me say this, that the only way that you could survive without dying of hunger was if you were able to buy food on the black market, because your rations, if that's all you had, you were doomed to die. Smuggling was going on. Young boys, 8, 10, 12 years old, would go over the wall on the other side, the Aryan side. Excuse me. And bring food back. And, of course, it was a no-no. If you got caught smuggling, you were shot at the wall. That was the penalty, to let the others know that that's not the thing to do. We communicated with a town, with an individual, approximately 100 miles northeast of Warsaw.
How did you communicate?
Postcards, letters. Even though we were completely isolated from the rest of the world, the mail functioned. And I even have with me a card that was written by my grandfather to us after our escape. But anyway, the main thing was that the gentleman that my dad befriended was telling Dad by writing that in their town, which was small, things were normal, that people were going about their work. Most people were farmers, and so were these people by the name of Zilberman. And his advice to Dan was try to find a means of getting out of there. And if you do, come to us. We'll open our house to you, and all you have to do is help us out with our farming chores, and you're going to be our guests. Mm-hmm. Dad took it to heart and found an individual that was also involved in smuggling. But he wasn't smuggling potatoes and carrots over the wall. He was smuggling people. Mm-hmm. He had the contacts, and there was a streetcar line that traversed the ghetto area, with the rules being that as long as it was within the ghetto, Jews could use it if they had the fare. Once it was about to leave the area, they had to get off. Having the contact, knowing the conductor and the motorman and the policeman, everybody looked the other way, and in two shifts, this gentleman got the family out.
How many members of the family were there involved in this part?
At that time, it was mom, grandfather, paternal grandfather, Mike and I. Father was retained in a labor camp. He wasn't with us at that time. So that was the four of us. We're on a street gun, two shifts.
And managed successfully, obviously, to get out, and then went to the Zilberman farm, Mike?
Yes, went to Zilberman. I would like to add something to what Jerry said right now, because I recall this event very, very clearly. We waited for, first of all, the driver of the streetcar was bribed. But would you believe what he was bribed with a sack of potatoes? So that was the price of Jewish lives in those days, okay? We stood at the sidewalk, and when the streetcar approached, we entered. Mother tore off the armband, And we sat down, okay? And I was sitting there, and two German soldiers, helmets on, rifles, came to check for Jews. Because as Jerry said, if Jews were obliged to leave the streetcar. And the soldiers went by and were looking for Semitic features. Anyone who looked like a Jew would be in bad shape, okay? And the soldier looked at me, and I smiled. And I don't know to this day why I smiled, for God's sake. It could have been, I smiled at him, and he was sort of taken back, you know, and he smiled back and went on. Okay, it could have been an instinct of self-preservation or something that made me, because I was inside, I was just bunched up with absolute fear. I knew it at that time, what if it doesn't work, what we can expect.
I'll bet you were a cute kid.
Thank you.
So out you go, and I want to get you to the farm, because that's an extraordinary part of the story, the way in which you lived in the farm. They put you up in the barn, actually under the barn. Go ahead, sure. Jerry.
Okay. No, we lived, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mike. We lived with the Zilberman family. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about farm, at this point, we're talking about the tiny little farm that the Zilbermans had. Mm-hmm. Not our farm and not the farm where we survived. There were three farms involved. Mm-hmm. The farm that the Zilbermans had was very small. We stayed at their house. They shared their house with us. And we stayed there until the moment we stopped getting mail from the Warsaw Ghetto, because the rest of the family remained, grandparents and uncles and so on. And we communicated by writing to each other. But all of a sudden, the mail stopped. Mm-hmm. No more letters from Warsaw. Plus the fact that being a community very close to what later on turned out to be the Treblinka death camp, some people managed to jump off those moving trains and would filter into our community and tell us where it all started. They were really loaded on trains in the Warsaw Ghetto, and for a while there was the big lie that you're being transported to Russian farms to produce food for the German army. Of course, that turned out to be a big lie. That once the people left, that was the end of it.
So you knew that the ring was closing in on you, I suppose.
Exactly.
Right.
And really, it became obvious that things were going wrong at the time when the German army attacked the Soviet Union. That was the breaking point. Mm-hmm. Because in order to get from where we were to the Russian territory, they had to capture the eastern part of Poland, which was at the beginning in 1939 taken over by the Soviets. So to their surprise, they found that the largest percentage of the Jewish population of Poland was in those eastern parts. So all of a sudden they found themselves ruling over a very large Jewish population. And that's when Mike mentioned the Wannsee conference that took place, where the bigwigs got together and said, our method of putting people in ghettos is not going to solve our...
The final solution of the question, right, is where that was decided. So when did you move to the farm where you ultimately wound
up? We have to inject here a event which is very dramatic in this little town, which was incidentally called Kosov. Kosov, okay? And we began to hear that in the surrounding communities and towns, events were taking place which were called Aktias. This comes from the German word Aktion, action, okay? And what it involved is that the Jewish community would be surrounded at night usually by Germans, Ukrainians, helpers, and Polish police, and taken to a main market place and put on trains and sent to death. And this event also descended on us. One day, I remember very clearly how it happened. We survived by lying still under the floor of a warehouse, just about 2 or 3 inches from the floors. We were searched. The people upstairs were searching for us. They didn't find. We heard shots being fired at peeding, at people hiding. And we survived. And after this, we were put in a ghetto in this little town, Kosuv, and from there we escaped to the farm.
All right. Tell me about the farm. That's part of the story that our listeners want to hear.
The people, first of all, let's say this, that there were posters everywhere cautioning the population in general that anybody caught aiding Jews or a Jewish family were going to be eliminated.
Sure.
So there was really very little chance of somebody giving you a helping hand. Dad figured that the only way that the family could survive was to be hidden by somebody.
Let me interrupt here. Sure. I thought Dad was in a labor camp at this point. Did he rejoin you somewhere along the way?
He was released.
Okay.
And joined us.
Okay.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is absolutely correct. He rejoined us. Mm-hmm. And his idea was that if he could possibly find somebody that would be willing to take the risk, he would reward them by transferring the ownership. And this is a fact that we haven't talked about yet, that among the other things that Dad was involved in was the ownership of a 60-acre farm, which was in the area where we were now.
Mm-hmm.
And he contacted a couple of young men who by this time lost their parents, two brothers, one probably 21, the other one maybe 18, and said, you've lived here all your lives and you know a lot of people. If you find somebody who is willing to take a chance on hiding us, the farm, the 60-acre farm is theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So the young boys got serious about it and came up with a family by the name of Gural. Jan Gural was the man's name, with a large family. There was wife and son and daughter-in-law and three daughters that took us in.
And they let you stay in the barn, but the condition there was quite different. You had to live beneath the barn.
No, the plan was not living in the barn itself, never. It was immediately, the plan was to dig a shelter. We called it a bunker under the floor of the barn and, of course, camouflage it in such a way that if a stranger walked in, he wouldn't know anything about it. And the reward for the two brothers that I mentioned was the ability to go into hiding with us. So now we're talking about four members of our family, two of the brothers is six, and we don't really have time to get into how the number of people that were in the shelter increased to 11.
Increased to 11, yes. You remember that, Mike, obviously?
Very clearly.
Yeah.
And I would like to add here something, because I remember so clearly the night when we left the Kosovo ghetto in order to get to the farm. okay? We began walking, and there was a deep snow. And I was getting tired already. And we walked without end, okay? And we did not realize that we were walking in the direction of Treblinka. And when I think about it now, I see that all the time it was as if this terrible place was pulling us towards it until we wound up something like less than 2 miles away from it, two to three mm-hmm. kilometers. Because from our hometown to Warsaw was eastward. To this place, Kosów, was northeastward. And Treblinka was north of that point. Mm-hmm. And we kept getting closer and closer. And I'll tell you that I think that not little of the fact that we survived was because our hiding place was so close to Treblinka that the Germans never thought of searching it for hidden Jews. And had we run away, had we known that this place it was second to Auschwitz, incidentally, in the number. So we would have run, okay? Had we run, I'm sure we would not have survived. Yeah.
And I have to take another break, but you could actually smell Treblinka from where you were.
Right, absolutely. And we were within smelling distance.
And what I mean by that, you were smelling the smoke from the ovens in which
There were no ovens, no.
What was you were smelling?
There were pyres. The bodies were piled on pyres and burned, and the smell was terrible over a very large area. Okay, and we had it with us for a few weeks.
Well, that was what life was like for Jerry and Mike Koenig during this part of the war. We're talking about Holocaust survival, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and the survival of these two gentlemen from that awful, awful period in history. I have to take another break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Jerry and Mike in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with Jerry and Mike Koenig. They are Holocaust survivors. We're talking about their experiences during the course of World War II when they hid to avoid capture by the Germans and the ultimate horror that so many people faced during that particular period. Time is beginning to get away from us just a little bit here, and I hate to rush a story, but it's such a powerful story that we would need much more time than we actually have. But I want to talk about life in this this hollowed-out area under the barn. I'll come back to you, Jerry, for that. Give me a kind of a brief sense, if you will, of what life was like for the 11.
Well, first of all, the family assumed the responsibility of feeding 11 people. We had no idea how long this whole thing was going to last, whether it was going to be the war was going to be over in 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years. The food was brought to us once a day. The three teenage girls were the ones who would bring the food to us. It was a pot of soup and a loaf of bread that had to be divided among 11 people. Sanitary conditions were important because you had 11 people and the environment was strictly straw. And that was a wonderful area for things like bed bugs and lice.
How big an area was it?
Okay. I recreated the dimensions because there was 11 of us. And if you take 11 people and put them down on the floor side by side, it takes about 24 feet. One of the brothers that found the shelter for us was a little over 6 feet tall. When he stretched out, he went wall to wall. So we got 24 by 6 and about 4.5 feet deep.
Hi. So you were small, but the others weren't. They were adults. They would have to walk stooped over when they walked.
Actually, he was the only one that was able to walk straight without stooping over.
Oh, Mike? No.
I also had to bend down my head a little bit.
Did you have opportunities to get out at all? I mean, at night, could you leave and get fresh air?
Well, the fresh air was actually filling the barn, you know. So in order to get fresh air down below, there was a trap door through which we could get in and out. and it had to be lifted a little bit in order for air to come in, not necessarily directly from the outside, but for what was in the barn.
Mike, how did you spend your days? What did you do? I mean, you were there for ultimately 22 months, I think I read. Is that correct? Yeah.
Thanks to Jerry, who fashioned for us a chess set out of bread. Okay, he dyed one set of chessmen red from the beet juice or something like this, and he left the other one as it is. And Father taught us how to play chess, and we spent a lot of time doing it. Also, the farmer every once in a while would bring us a newspaper, and Father would sit with us and read for us the paper. And we also even had some card games, but everything in very, very great silence. Anything that we did.
Detection was something that
you would
fear.
Obviously.
Were there any Germans nearby that could hear any kind of...
Not so much Germans, but believe me that we feared the neighbors more than the Germans, okay?
Right. So your father basically educated you, as I understand the story.
As much as he could. To read, even,
I want to get back to the silence, because I think of the many dramatic parts to your story, one of the most dramatic is the fact that during the time you were there, a baby was born. To whom was the baby born?
To one of the people, the additional people. Remember, we counted up six, and there were five additional ones.
Right.
And one of those was a woman who came in, a young woman probably at that time, maybe in her very early 20s, or maybe not even 20, I don't know. And she was pregnant. And as days were going by, she was getting bigger and bigger. And at least to my recollection, the adults never really got together and worked out a plan. What are we going to do when that baby is born?
Of course, the concern was that babies cry.
Very much so. And what really made the story more involved is the fact that at the very same time, Mr. Gura's daughter-in-law was carrying a baby. And for a while looked like the two women, one upstairs and one below, were in a race with each other, which one was going to deliver first. And the baby came first to the woman upstairs. And it was a very difficult delivery. A midwife had to be called. It was a little boy and never made it. He died at birth. About a day or two later, a little girl was born in the bunker. And there was really nothing wrong with it. It was a relatively easy delivery. And the thought was expressed that maybe somehow or another we could swap kids. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it wouldn't fly because a midwife was involved. And one was a boy and one was a girl.
And she knew, and it was, okay, so, Mike.
Then I wrote a poem, which also I included here. It'll take about 2 minutes. Tell me if we have time. If we don't, I'll skip it.
Let's move along to the rest of the story and then come back to it
if
we do have time, okay?
Okay.
What happened? What decision was made with regard to the baby?
The baby was basically... To say it very cruelly, she was sentenced to death. Okay, and it was performed by the farmer's wife coming down one day and giving, and the mother of the baby sat down on the floor and fed the little girl with what was essentially poison tea. Okay, it was not poisoned, but it was some sort of a herb which put her to sleep. Okay, and the baby... And I can recall when the man took the little baby and in the middle of the night went out and buried the baby.
How was this decision made? I mean, was there a vote?
I don't know. Frankly, I don't know.
Do you know, Jerry?
No, other than the fact that Mr. Gural and his wife, I'm sure, had a very important input into this thing because... Not only were our lives at stake, but their whole family would have been wiped out. Right. And of course, silence was of utmost importance.
And the mother, what was her outlook and reaction to all of this?
Well, mother knew that she was giving the baby a poisonous liquid that was going to kill her.
You know, I hate to ask this question, and you've probably been asked it before, but it's one that has to be asked. What made the taking of the life of that child really any different than what the Nazis were doing?
Saving 11 lives. And there was no doubt about it that if the baby was left, she was crying. And she, as I told you before, she had a very good reason to cry because she was being eaten alive by the insects that we had in the bunker.
You know, I have to feel of all that you went through, and I'm the outsider looking in, and I never had anything close to the kind of experiences that you've had. But, Mike, I'd have to feel that this may have been the absolute worst part of it.
Yes. There is another incident which also embedded itself in our memories, but this one is absolutely, like you say, a trauma which I don't believe will ever get over it, okay? And again, if we have time, I'll read it out. But it was this incident and another incident which also is very deep in our memory, but we'll come to it.
And that is, tell me now. We've got about 8 minutes left.
8 minutes left. We were in our hiding, and the Zilberman family, which has given us their home when we escaped from the Warsaw Ghetto.
It was the first stop.
Right. Okay, there is no doubt that they saved our lives, okay, because the ghetto in Warsaw was getting worse and horrible. Okay, they also found a farmer, but the farmer turned them out. And they knew where we are, and there was a little forest nearby, and they were in this forest, and the man, Mr. Zilberman, came to our farmer to ask whether he can join us in hiding. And our farmer said, look, I have already 11 people. I cannot feed them. This is impossible. So he turned them out, okay? The father went back to the forest. Within a day, these people were murdered in a very cold-blooded fashion. And what's really shocking is that Mrs. Zilberman's head was missing.
Oh.
And the reason is very obvious. I remember it so clearly. Her mouth was full of gold teeth. And they took her head away, apparently, to do their job of extracting them in their homes. So that's, I think these two, the baby and this, there were many other incidents, but these two are so deeply embedded in our minds.
Of course, the taking of the gold teeth was fairly commonplace in the camps after people were exterminated.
Right.
Such a story. I mean, it's incredible to hear it told first person. Liberation. Jerry, liberation. How and what the circumstances were?
Well, of course, the only people at that time that we could count on were the Soviets coming. They were the closest. And I like to mention that reading the newspaper had us convinced that Germany was going to lose the war. There were a lot of things going on, war in Africa, landing in Sicily, in Italian, and then later on, of course, the landing in France, in the Normandy. But the thing that wasn't clear at all was whether the Soviets would make it in time far enough east to liberate us. And as we know, that the German attack was very successful. They got as far as Moscow in the south, as far as Stalingrad. And that is where the German offensive petered out. They took their first defeat at Stalingrad, and from then on it was retreating back east. Well, I'm sorry, west.
And the day that they arrived, how did you know they were there?
Mr. Gurov stuck his head into the bunker, lifted the trap door, and said, they're gone. Those were his words. They're gone.
So you all stepped out of that pit in the barn for the first time?
For me, yes, that was the first time.
Mike, you too, I assume.
Yes, absolutely. And I would just like to say a few words here that we were not really aware that the front line is coming close, okay? And apparently at that time when we were so unsure, the line was passing over us, okay? And I remember so clearly that moment when I stepped out of the barn. We did not dare go out through the main gate of the barn, okay? We were afraid. So we pushed aside one of the, how do you say? Okay, aside one of the,
one of the gates? Walls that
gates?
No, no,
trap
no.
Door?
Okay, anyway, we formed a opening, a tight opening, and I stepped outdoors. And it was really a very thrilling experience because all of a sudden my universe expanded from just a little hole that I used to look at the world to a great big huge place, you know, where I could look wherever I wanted. And so it was quite
stars and quite sunshine and wind
everything,
and rain
the wind and,
all the rest
and breeze
of it.
right
mm-hmm. and very very quickly the Russians the treatment by the Russians,
it was fine. We were very glad to see them, and they were they couldn't believe that we were really alive people, because we were just as white as snow. It's amazing what the lack of sunshine for 2 years will do to your skin.
One can only begin to imagine what that was like.
And none of us were overweight.
I read your poem now, Mike. We have, I think, if you can do it in under 2 minutes.
Yes,
I hate to rush any of this, but we are.
Incidentally, the word that I was looking for is board. One of the boards. Okay. My English is getting a little bit, okay. Oh, little girl, oh, little baby, you were born so healthy but had to die. If only you could have promised to be quiet. If only you could have promised not to cry. Your mother bore you during the war, under a barn, in a shelter of straw. And if you were not quiet, 11 people would die. That's why, little baby, we could not let you cry. I remember the flame of the kerosene lamp singeing the scissors for cutting your cord. I remember so clearly your first lusty yell forcing its way through the shelter's trap door. Above in the farmhouse, at the same time, a baby like you was born and died. We wanted to put you in a dead baby's crib, but the midwife knew. That's why, little girl, you had to die too. I remember your mother holding you tight while placing a spoon to your lips. Sip your tea, baby. Hush and don't cry. You'll soon hear eternity's sad lullaby. I am sorry, oh baby, that you had to die. If only you could have promised to be quiet. If only you could have promised not to cry.
Oh, that is so powerful. I'm sure a lot of people have the same reaction I do. That's wonderful. I'd like a copy of that. I think we want to put that on
it's
our
website. It's yours right now.
We have just a minute left, and there were so many other things I wanted to talk about, but let me get a quick reaction. It has to be quick, Jerry and Mike, to what happened in Kansas City just a couple of weeks ago. Once again, Jews under attack.
Well, of course, the irony of this whole thing is that none of the victims were Jewish. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that the man was around for many years. He was a leader in the Ku Klux Klan. He was openly proclaiming his case, and therefore I cannot understand how this kind of an individual was allowed to work, to live that long.
He was an anti-Semite, and anti-Semitism is still rife, unfortunately, after all these years. I have to end it there. Mike, very quickly.
I can only second. I can only second what Jerry said.
Oh, sure, I'm sure. I wish we had more time to discuss that. Mike has written a book, by the way, At the Edge of an Abyss, the story of Holocaust survival near the death camp of Michael Koenig. Michael, we'll make that available somehow to people, too. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing
your
difficult story. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about spring planting and gardening with two horticulture experts from the Missouri Botanical Garden, so get your questions ready. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.